Hello, this is Lee Webb, host of Renewing Your Mind with Dr. R.C. Sproul. It is with a sad and heavy heart that I let you know of the passing of our dear friend, the founder of Ligonier Ministries, Dr. R.C. Sproul. He passed away Thursday afternoon around 3 o'clock, surrounded by family, his beloved wife, Vesta, his daughter, son-in-law, and several grandchildren. We already miss Dr. Sproul terribly, and we know that you do as well. If you'd like more information, perhaps you'd like to convey your condolences to the family, we invite you to go to rcsproul.com. You'll find other information there, including plans for a memorial service next Wednesday. In the meantime, thank you for listening to Renewing Your Mind. John Calvin seemed to have systematic theology in mind from his earliest years.
He wrote as really quite a young man, just 25 or 26, his first edition of the Institutes, and amazed people who read it that such a young man could write with such balance, such insight, such systematic care.
John Calvin, theologian, pastor, and reformer. He came a generation after Martin Luther, but Calvin's influence on the church today is every bit as significant. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb. And every week on the Saturday edition of this broadcast, we return to Dr. W. Robert Godfrey's survey of church history. For the past several months, he's guided us from the apostolic era and now into the Reformation. Today, Dr. Godfrey will explain how the Reformation grew under the leadership of Calvin. Dr. Godfrey is a teaching fellow here at Ligonier Ministries, as well as President Emeritus of Westminster Seminary, California. Let's join him now as he introduces our study.
Well, I promise you we would plunge right into Calvin, but, it's good to have desires, you know, delayed so that they become even more precious when they're fulfilled. And I do think we need to say just a little bit about the Reformation in Germany after Luther. Things don't all come to an end with the death of Luther in 1546. In fact, not long after the death of Luther, the Emperor Charles V felt that he was in a position finally to take some action against the Lutheran German princes. The threat of advancing Islam on the Eastern Front had receded. That's a whole story in itself about how Luther survived in part because of the Muslims putting pressure on the emperor in the East. The empire's problems with France had receded, and now the emperor thought, I can clean up the heretics at home. War broke out then in Germany, 1546-47, and by 1548, the Lutheran princes were defeated, and the emperor imposed upon them what came to be known as the Augsburg Interim Peace. And in that interim peace, he said, as long as you all outwardly practice Roman Catholicism, you can believe in your hearts whatever you want. Now, this led to a lot of tension. Do we go along with that? If we can believe in our hearts, didn't Luther say it's what's in your heart that really matters? And Philip Melanchthon, timid Philip, was one who thought, well, let's maybe go that way. But most of the Lutherans said, absolutely not. We cannot go back to the external idolatry that we abandoned in the Mass. And so there was quite a bit of Protestant suffering in Germany, but it also became clear as time passed to the emperor that this was not succeeding, that he was not rooting out Protestantism, and that much more drastic measures would be required and weren't really possible. The German princes were reasserting themselves. Even some of the Roman Catholic princes were a little concerned about the extent of the emperor's power now, and it's all about power. And that meant that the emperor was forced to retreat, and it became clear that he was going to have to sign a treaty to make peace with the Protestant princes and allow for Protestantism to survive in the empire. Charles could not face it and abdicated. Quite a remarkable action. He abdicated and entered a monastery. And so it was his successor, his brother, who signed the Peace of Augsburg, as it's known. Augsburg Confession, Augsburg Interim, Augsburg Peace. It's all pretty confusing. But if you're uncertain as to what the right answer to a history question is, try Augsburg and it may work. 1555, what the Augsburg Peace said was that the Lutheran Reformation could stay where it had advanced already, and that it would be up to the prince to determine what the territory ought to be. There were some additional provisions, but that was the great decision. And what it did then for the first time was to legalize Protestantism in the empire. Not the Reformed, only the adherents of the Augsburg Confession. But it was a massive step forward. It still wasn't final, because even this piece said, until we can reach a final resolution of these matters, Protestants will be tolerated in the territories in which they find themselves. So this was a very momentous step forward in the history of Europe for the first time in 1,000 years, 1,100 years. Europe was committed to the notion there could be more than one legal religion in the realm. And this is a step towards the modern world as we know it. With this peace, of course, one of the things that often happens in peace is that people who are united against a common enemy can now fall to fighting with one another. And so some of the Lutheran theologians began to go at it with one another, leading to the necessity of the preparation in 1575 of the last of the Lutheran confessional documents known as the Formula of Concord. And the Formula of Concord was designed to bring harmony or concord between warring Lutheran factions. It's an interesting document. It thinks at various points it attacks Calvinists. We're still the bad guys. Actually, I think usually we're not described very accurately in the Formula of Concord. But nonetheless, Lutheranism was now taking its distinctive form and would not spread a great deal after these years. It was already established in Scandinavia, and it was clear that from this point on, Calvinism would become the really energetic form of Calvinism that would continue to spread and continue to grow in Europe. And so with that somewhat awkward segue, we move to John Calvin. Calvin is an interesting historical figure, just as there's controversy about Luther. Who was he? How do we understand his psychology, his language, some of the problems with Luther? The problem with Calvin is, in a sense, that he's hardly viewed as human. There's a little book written a number of decades ago now called The Humanity of John Calvin, sort of as if it was in doubt. Calvin has almost been treated sometimes like, you know, a great disembodied brain in Geneva, just sitting there thinking and turning out work. And if we think about him beyond just being a brain, many see him just as sort of gloomy, oppressive. You know, the definition of, was it of a Calvinist or of a Puritan? It doesn't really matter, but a Puritan is one who fears that somewhere someone is having a good time. And that isn't fair to Puritanism, and it certainly isn't fair to John Calvin, but it is sort of the general impression that Calvin has left in the popular mind of our day. And I think it is really worth the investment to try to get back behind that to see the real Calvin. That's why I wrote my little book on Calvin, Calvin, Pilgrim and Pastor, because I think the most important thing about Calvin was, first of all, that he was a pilgrim following Christ to find the truth as it was in Christ. And secondly, that he was a pastor. I think for Calvin, all of his theological work was to help him and others do pastoral work. You know, we have a lot of people today who are pastors who really want to be theologians, and they just need to be pastors to pay the bills. That is tragic for the life of the church. We need pastors who want to be pastors, who want to preach, and who want to be out with the people to help them. Calvin was a pastor like that, and he did his theological work and his biblical studies to help him and others in the pastoral work. And in that sense, we see the heart of Calvin. He wasn't just a brain. He thought getting things right in your brain was important. But it was so that Christian lives could be properly balanced in a biblical way. That was his passion. He was born in 1509, so he's a whole generation younger than Martin Luther. 26 years, I think, younger than Martin Luther. He looked up to Martin Luther. He recognized there were problems in Martin Luther. He recognized the problem of hyperbole. He recognized the problem of excessive virulence in language. But he said, Luther was the pioneer. Luther was the one who guided us. Luther was a great man. He didn't agree with Luther on everything, but he felt the great contribution of Luther should never be diminished or attacked. And I think he's right about that. Nonetheless, he thought, there were ways forward. There were some things that could be improved. And theology was one of those areas, because Calvin had a genuinely systematic mind. Remember I said Luther was sort of an occasional theologian. He could write great things on specific topics, but not always fully taking into account the implications of those topics for other topics. Calvin seems always to have had the systematic theology in mind. He wrote as really quite a young man, just 25 or 26, his first edition of the Institutes. Now, we mustn't think of the big two-volume work that it grew to become, but still it was a substantial volume when it was first produced and amazed people who read it that such a young man could write with such balance, such insight, such systematic care. Now, again, he's a second-generation theologian. He had all the advantages of being able to read Luther and Bucer and Zwingli and all of the many theologians that preceded him, but still to be able to take that and to formulate it in a way that would be helpful for the church, clear, is amazing. And he seemed to have such clarity as he worked about how he was going to do his work. Martin Bucer, that we talked about briefly in the last lecture, was famous for being long-winded when he wrote. And he wrote this very long commentary on Romans. And part of the reason that it was very long was he would pause at various points to write little theological chapters or treatises in the midst of it to explain things. And Calvin concluded, I don't want to do that. I don't think that's a good way to do things. And so, in his commentaries, he'd be writing along and he'd say, for a full development of this theological point, see my Institutes. So he didn't pause in the commentary to write the long theological point. He referred them to his theology. And occasionally in the Institutes, he'll say, for the exegetical foundation of this theological point, see my commentaries. So he seemed to know always where he was going, what he was doing, how the pieces of his life fit together. And there definitely were pieces to his life. You have the systematic side of Calvin. He wrote the Institutes, but he also wrote treatises on theology. Then he wrote his commentaries, some 50 volumes of commentaries. Some of them prepared for publication, others taken down just as notes from his public lectures. Then he wrote 35 volumes of letters. He was a great advisor, a great counselor of people, ministers, individuals, theological counsel, but personal counsel as well. It's another way he exercised his pastoral office beyond the confines of Geneva. Then he was a preacher. We had, at one point, about 2,500 manuscripts of his sermons. They were taken down longhand. Some of them were printed, some of them were not. The ones that were not printed were put in the Geneva Public Library, and in the early 19th century, some librarian said, we need more shelf space, and threw a bunch of them away. So we've lost forever some of his sermons, but we still have a lot of his sermons, and what's intriguing is how different his sermons are from the commentary on the same passage. It's not that the exegesis is different or the theology is different, but the content is different. The sermons are pastoral, they're application. He doesn't spend anywhere near as much time on exegesis in the sermons as you might expect him to do, but he's applying the truth to the people of God. It's amazing what he was able to accomplish in his lifetime. How did all this happen? Where did he come from? Who was this guy? What formed John Calvin? Well, he was a Frenchman. He was born outside of Paris in the small city of Noyon, kind of northeast of Paris. He too was seen as a talented young man by his father, and he began to receive a Renaissance education from early on. That's another of the ways in which he was a generation younger than Luther. He didn't receive an education in medieval theology. He had to learn that later. He received an education in the study of humanist texts of Greek and Latin and Hebrew. And like Luther's father, his father thought the best thing for this young man is to go to law school. And like Luther, he dutifully went, but wasn't very happy about it. And continued in law school until he received word that his father had died, and then he quit law school. But not to become a monk, not to become a theologian, but become a literary scholar. That was the great ideal of many humanists, many Renaissance learned men of that time, to become a scholar. And the great thing to do was to edit a text. So he got Seneca, the Roman philosopher, Stoic philosopher who had tried to teach Nero morals. Not a very successful philosopher. But Seneca, the ancient Roman philosopher, who had written a treatise, De Clemencia, on mercy. And Calvin wrote an incredibly learned commentary on Seneca's De Clemencia. It's worth getting sometime just to look at, to see the learning, the range of ancient texts he had read and was familiar with, so he could comment on what the language was doing, what the philosophy was doing, what the ethics were doing. And nobody paid much attention when it was published. I don't know how much attention he thought he'd get from a treatise like that. But it was a real disappointment, and it led him to sort of re-examine his life. And it would appear that somewhere after that, he said he was suddenly converted. We don't know exactly what that means. Calvin was very hesitant to talk about himself. Sometimes with Luther, you feel every thought that goes through his head, he wrote down. Calvin wrote a great deal, but he writes very little about himself. He doesn't want to put himself forward. It's not about his experience. And the one place where he does let his guard down a little bit, I don't think it's that he really is guarded. I don't think it's that he doesn't want to talk about himself. He just wants to say it's not about me. It's about Christ. It's about his word. It's not my experience. It's what the word says that's important. Why should you care about my experience? The one place where he does talk about himself a little bit is in his preface to his commentary on Psalms. Like Luther, Calvin loved the Psalms. He preached on the Psalms. It was the only book of the Old Testament that he preached on Sunday. Kind of interesting. Preached on the Psalms Sunday afternoon. Sunday morning, he always preached from the New Testament. But the sufferings of David obviously really spoke to Calvin and his own personal experience. And so in that preface, he talks about how much the book of Psalms has meant to him, how much he's identified with it in his own experience. And there we have this comment that he was suddenly converted. Probably the best way to take that is he was unexpectedly converted. He wasn't expecting it. It may not be so much just that it happened in a moment, but that the whole process of conversion is not what he had anticipated earlier in his life. He was surrounded by a number of fellow students who had been already converted to Protestantism. So in that sense, maybe it shouldn't have been so surprising. But again, probably reading Luther, certainly influenced by other young men who had read Luther, Calvin comes to this point of conversion and rather rapidly discovers France is not a very friendly place for young men persuaded of Protestantism. And so he decides he would like to leave France and go to Strasbourg, where Bucer is, whom he greatly admires. He knows there are some French refugees there. Maybe he can help out with those refugees. He thinks it'll be a peaceful place to study. Well, it happened that Germany and France were on the verge of war. You know, fill in the blank many places in history. But so he decides to take a detour and to travel around what he thinks might be the front, which will take him through Geneva. And he doesn't plan to stay in Geneva. You've probably heard this story. He's really planning to carry on. And William Farel, not a hard name, but French names are always a little surprising. William Farel, who had been the reformer of Geneva, who'd really led to the Reformation in Geneva, was one of those rare men who knew his own limits. And Farel knew he was a good preacher, he was a good persuader, but he wasn't a good organizer. And he said, we need somebody with more organizational skills than I've got to consolidate the Reformation begun here in Geneva. And when he heard that Calvin was in town, he thought, I've read that young man's Institutes. He has an orderly mind. He's the man we need. We need him to stay. And so Farel came and pled with Calvin to stay. Calvin said, no thanks, I'm called to be a scholar. I'm going to Strasbourg to lead a quiet life. And Farel said, if you don't stay and help us, God will grant no peace to your studies. And Calvin said, I felt I heard the voice of God in those words. And so really contrary to what he wanted to do, he stayed. And it was not an easy time. Calvin was impatient. By all accounts, he had something of a short fuse. He apparently didn't suffer fools gladly. He got mad too easily. He would admit that candidly to himself. And he really had not figured out how he was going to deal with this city council that was in charge of the Reformation in Geneva. and yet was unwilling fully to do what the ministers thought. Whereas Luther really looked to the magistrate as an emergency bishop, wanted the magistrate, the princes, to provide leadership, Calvin, in some ways you could say, was more medieval, in that Calvin really thought the princes ought to do what the ministers said. And the Calvinist clergy has always sort of kind of thought that, that people really ought to do what the ministers say. And since I is one, I agree with them. Now, Calvin, as a young man, hadn't really thought through how he was going to relate to the city council. Luther liked princes to take leadership, but Calvin always thought that the princes on matters of religion really ought to listen to the ministers and follow the ministers. And the area in which he got into trouble with the city council was on the matter of discipline, church discipline. Calvin believed very strongly it was not enough to preach the gospel and teach the gospel. He said there needs to be discipline under the gospel. And for Calvin, that meant the church had to have the right of excommunication. If people were living grossly in sin, the church had to have the right to discipline those people for the honor of Christ's name and the purity of the church. The city council was willing to go along with that up to a point, and the point at which they were not willing to go is if the church thought it had the right to excommunicate important people. It's fine for the church to discipline ordinary people, but these crazy ministers thought they had the right to discipline rich people and politically powerful people, and this was really intolerable. So they wrestled with this, they struggled with this, and just before the Easter communion, after Calvin had been in Geneva about 18 months, Calvin served notice that they would not serve communion if they could not exercise discipline. Now the city council said, well, we'll exercise discipline for you. And Calvin said, that's not good enough. And so Calvin and the ministers refused to administer communion at all, which was like excommunicating the whole town. And the city council was livid, and they kicked Calvin out. And Calvin was thrilled. He was delighted to get out of there. He said, I didn't think in the first place I had a temperament for this. It's not where I wanted to be. It's not where I thought I ought to be. I am just so glad to be out of here. Now, he went on to Strasbourg, and he was appointed pastor of a refugee congregation of about 400 French refugees there in Strasbourg. It was a place where he could begin to do more writing. He wrote his first commentary there. I'm always amazed when Calvin thought, what is my first commentary? He thought, I'll write on Nahum. No, that's what I would have done. My young man, first commentary, I'd write on Nahum. Calvin wrote on Romans. Can you imagine writing on Romans as your first commentary? And it's a splendid commentary. It's one of the best Romans commentaries ever written. So he settles down in Strasbourg. We're going to have to leave him there at this point, but Calvin is finally in a place where he wants to be, is happy to be, but we'll discover the Lord soon has other plans for him.
Calvin wrote in Book 3 of his Institutes, in the midst of troubles, hardships, annoyances, and other burdens, the Christian will find great relief when he remembers that God is his guide. From practical Christian living to deep systematic theology, John Calvin's legacy is broad. And as our survey of church history continues week to week here on the Saturday edition of Renewing Your Mind, we'll see that more clearly. Dr. Robert Godfrey has guided us from the birth of the church through the Reformation so far, and will continue with the series right up to modern times. Over the course of 4 years, Dr. Godfrey returned to our campus here in Florida to teach this series, 73 lessons in all, and we've compiled them into 12 DVDs. We'd be happy to send you the entire series for your gift of any amount today. Contact us to request yours. You can find us at renewingyourmind.org, or you can simply call us at 800-435-4343. Dr. Godfrey has pointed out from time to time in this series that, you know, many Christians believe that church history began with the Reformation. But keep in mind, 1,500 years had transpired before Luther and the Reformers. So it's important for us as believers to understand how Christian thought has developed since the early church. For your gift of any amount, we'll send you this 73-lesson series on 12 DVDs. Again, our phone number is 800-435-4343, or you can make your request at renewingyourmind.org. Students of church history are also students of God's Word. And everything we do here at Ligonier Ministries has the aim of equipping growing Christians. And that's why I want to remind you about RefNet. It's our 24-hour internet radio station. We highlight the ministries of faithful teachers like Alistair Begg, John Piper, John MacArthur, and even vintage recordings of men like Martin Lloyd-Jones. In addition, you'll hear music, news, Christian audiobooks, and more. You can listen for free 24 hours a day at refnet.fm, or you can download the free RefNet app. Well, next Saturday, we'll see how God interrupted the plans of John Calvin to bring him back to Geneva, where he would leave a permanent mark on Reformed theology. So join us next weekend for Renewing Your Mind.